Welcome to this episode of the Here and Now podcast. My name is Dave Mons. I'm a student of psychology and philosophy and a professional pilot. My aim is to share big ideas from science and the humanities to get you thinking and to help you make sense of the world. Universal basic income. You've probably heard of it. It's been around for a long time. It first appeared in Renaissance intellectual Sir Thomas More's 1516 book, Utopia, which framed his vision of the social, political, and religious customs of a harmonious island population. Scholars and philosophers in every century since have continued to imagine a society in which all citizens receive a regular basic income. Today, it is a core policy of many political parties. The two-time US presidential candidate Andrew Yang has been espousing its virtues for years, as have Elon Musk and everyone's favourite social media oligarch, Mark Zuckerberg. Yet, despite numerous trial projects around the world, it has never been implemented at a national scale. And rightly so, you might be thinking. It is a utopian dreamland you're living in if you think we can afford to pay everyone to do nothing. Not only would it be financially prohibitive, it would lead to a society of idle bums lounging around doing nothing. It would create a moral hazard and signal the downfall of the work ethic and appreciation for working hard to earn what you get. Until recently, I thought much the same. I'd say, sure, we'd all have a bit of free money if there's some going, but there is a reason the majority of us are working, because that's the only way, and most of us enjoy our work. UBI, a policy for hippies and communists. If you want something in this life, get out there and earn it. What if I told you, though, that it isn't such a far-fetched policy, and that those objections are not actually supported by the evidence? What if I asked you to set aside your first thoughts on the topic, and have a think about what we could all stand to gain from a UBI, not just people currently on a welfare benefit, but all of us? Would such a policy benefit those worst off in our societies, or those in minorities who are otherwise marginalised? Or would it just make the gulf between social classes wider? What if I said UBI would actually be a good thing for social justice? Would that make any difference? If you're still listening, then I ask you to keep an open mind and hear me out, because a UBI offers a lot more benefits to society than you might have realised. We can begin to reveal those by unpacking what a universal basic income actually is. It's all in the name, really. There are four core tenets of a UBI. Firstly, it should be universal, that is, paid to every member of society, including children. It would not be paid to households, it would be paid to individuals. This is a crucial point for the following reasons. Current forms of family tax credits or welfare for families are paid on the basis of the size of the family unit. Inherent to this form of conditionality is the requirement that the family unit be maintained. What happens if a family unit is dysfunctional? Arguably all family units are at least partially dysfunctional, but what I mean is really dysfunctional, as in abusive or may otherwise provide an unsafe or damaging environment for children. Financial duress puts people under immense pressure. If government support is predicated on maintaining the family unit, then that compels people, particularly women in abusive relationships, to stay in that environment. A UBI paid to individuals would mean that each person has a source of income irrespective of their circumstances. This in itself offers the social justice benefit of freeing people to make decisions in their best interest rather than be prisoners to a system which is arbitrarily limiting. That it is paid to children is also of significance. Now, this does not mean that each child receives an allowance each week or whatever. Rather, it's that their portion of the basic income is paid to their legal caregiver on their behalf until they reach a certain age. This vastly simplifies existing welfare policies by removing conditions based on personal circumstances. The policy is naturally anti-discriminatory because each individual is considered equally, which leads to the second tenet. A UBI should be unconditional. This means it is not means-tested or attached to a prerequisite or any kind of spending conditionality. This is important and aligns with the universality of the UBI. A basic income is paid to everyone regardless of their circumstances. This is the first step in achieving wealth equity across society. You may be thinking, what about wealthy people who don't need the extra income? Wouldn't we be better off giving that to the poor people? That's not the point. The idea is that social values surrounding income are shifted so that we all see that regardless of circumstance, the basic income will be there. While a UBI is well suited to replacing some forms of welfare, it is not meant to be a substitute for only those who need it. It's for everyone. This has implications for both well-off people and the poor, as that money can be used in different ways. For people on lower incomes or without an income, that money is necessary for them to meet their basic needs. For someone with greater income security, that income can be utilized for other purposes, which may be more self-actualizing in nature. Furthermore, think about where your income is derived from. Many people become trapped in jobs that they do not enjoy because they can't afford to leave them. A UBI for income earners forms a supplement. It's all about increasing freedom of choice. Having that extra income means you could choose to stay in your current job and bank the additional income, or you could find work that is more fulfilling but which pays less, with the shortfall offset by the UBI. Imagine the job landscape if we could partially decouple work from income. Unpleasant, degrading, or boring jobs would either need to be better remunerated or phased out altogether. And what about unpaid work? This is probably one of the most important points about the social justice value of a UBI. Consider the types of work that people do in society which are unpaid. Volunteer work for charities or other community service organizations are one example. People naturally do this work because they want to help others. They're obviously not motivated by money, but they still need money to live, as we all do. Have you ever thought you'd like to do some volunteer work if only you had the time? If you didn't have to work as much because you had a supplementary basic income, then you would have that time. And for those people currently working in volunteer organizations, the UBI would be a minor form of recognition of the work and the time that they put in. This would fundamentally alter social values around volunteer work, which would have flow-on implications for how we all think of social justice. If you didn't have to make as many personal sacrifices to help others, if it was more accessible, then we could see more people offering their help to others, with a resulting increase in quality of life for both those contributing and those who need the support provided by those volunteers. How about raising children? Arguably, this is the most difficult job in the world. In a world where traditional gender roles still prevail, women are often the ones at home looking after the children while their husbands are at work. In single-income families, this establishes a dynamic surrounding income that is sewn into the fabric of society. Even the most egalitarian of households has an implicit recognition of the fact that the man earns the money, and so the woman relies on his labour for her livelihood. Yet the woman works from dawn till dusk and often long after, tending to the needs of the children. This is difficult, exhausting, and thankless work. Yes, dads have a crucial role to play, and there are many stay-at-home dads too, so in this case the roles would be reversed. And most men probably don't think of themselves as chauvinistic, but that dynamic exists regardless. Just because as a man you feel like you do not place any expectations on your wife, even though you are the breadwinner, how does she feel about it? How much tension does income create in your household? A UBI redresses this imbalance by recognizing the work of the stay-home parent, which is often a woman, and giving her a small bit of financial freedom and discretionary spending money. A family may choose to pool their UBI resources. Indeed, any individuals could form a group to combine their UBIs to have more options, but ultimately, by being universal and unconditional, it offers more independence and freedom to those in the home, especially women. What would you do with your time if you didn't have to work as much? Would you write or paint or play more golf? Maybe you'd study, further your education, or build a boat. All of the things you don't have the time for could be realized if you did not have to rely on your job as your only source of income. A UBI gives us more of our most precious commodity, time. But if you're concerned that a UBI would lead to people giving up their jobs, your fears would be unfounded. But we'll return to that point shortly. The third tenet of a UBI is that it is a basic income, not a total income. That is, it should be sufficient to ensure basic needs can be met, but not enough to live comfortably. This tenet is one of the most challenging, as we must define what is meant by basic needs. Of course, these will vary across different societies, depending on the standard of living people expect and are used to, and the size of their economies. Accordingly, a UBI may provide social mobility for those worst off, but it will not be life-changing any more than the welfare benefits present in the existing social protection floor systems are. Striking the balance between income and sufficiency is a significant challenge for any UBI proposal, as a sufficient UBI may not be affordable, but an affordable UBI may not be sufficient. Finally, it is an income, so it should be paid regularly in cash or a cash equivalent, not in conditional vouchers or something other than money. For instance, vouchers for a supermarket or food bank do not constitute a form of UBI, as they are conditional. You may think, well, the reason such a policy exists is that some people would just spend the money on alcohol and cigarettes, so they need to be forced to spend it on necessary items. This may be true for a small minority, but as a general statement, it's a discriminatory myth. Food insecurity is a serious issue for low-income families around the world, and it's a significant problem in New Zealand. New Zealand is often considered a land of plenty and one of the most desirable and egalitarian societies in the world, with an abundance of produce. In reality, it has the fifth highest rate of inequality in the OECD, and this becomes evident when we look at the research. I'm going to digress from UBI just briefly as we explore food insecurity, but it ties back into it, as you'll see. A study which followed 11 low-income families in New Zealand looked closely at how they managed their food. Over the course of 12 months, the participants shared their stories, they opened their pantries and revealed their income and expenditure. They even took the researchers grocery shopping with them. The study provided deep insights into how these people lived and made choices surrounding food and money. This is known as an ethnographic research approach, and it's often seen in anthropology and, say, community psychology. The study found significant shortfalls between recommended expenditure to achieve a healthy diet and the reality of the resources available. It's estimated that in New Zealand, a regular family of two adults and two school-aged children need to spend at least $260 a week to meet their nutritional requirements. However, the families described in this study had a maximum of $120 a week for all household-related expenses. When unexpected costs arose, such as medical bills or compulsory school costs, the food budget was the first to suffer. In contrast to commonly held stereotypes, the researchers found that parents usually knew how to budget, meet nutrition ideals, and to stretch meals. The problem was, there just wasn't enough money to go around. Another project carried out in 2013 and 14 in Auckland, called the Family 100 Project, was developed to bring about a deeper understanding of the experiences of families living in urban poverty. And this study found that, quote, negative media stereotyping and misinformation leads many to assume that people living in poverty do so because they are poor at managing their money and they lack the skills needed to balance a weekly budget. The vast majority of Family 100 participants prove this to be largely false and typically demonstrate considerable talents in their ability to budget. End quote. I've seen this firsthand in my own family, and also while wandering through the supermarket aisles and observing people carefully adding up items on a calculator. A lot of supermarkets these days even issue portable scanners so customers can add up their bills as they go, not only to save time at the checkout, but also to avoid the embarrassing situation of having to decide which items to discard when the total exceeds the bank account balance. Back to my point though, when low-income households receive an increase in income, they spend it on more food and better quality food, and they spend it on their children. A British study found that extra income is almost entirely spent on items for children. Another one in Australia also found extra money went on better food, and yet another study, this one conducted in Dunedin in the south of New Zealand, found that additional income went to purchasing fruit, vegetables and high-quality meat rather than processed cheap cuts. A UBI does not lift people out of poverty on its own merits. It's just one piece of a larger social puzzle. However, to say that it is a bad idea because it will make those worse off even more so because they cannot manage their finances effectively is patently false and strawmans the proposal. Furthermore, as the psychologists Kimberly Jackson and Rebecca Graham, who have worked extensively on food security, write, quote, "The provision of emergency food by charities enables the state to evade its responsibility to ensure that every citizen has adequate access to food. While mobilizing compassion through charities is currently crucial to feed hungry citizens who can no longer rely on the welfare state to avert hardship, charity is no substitute for a more equitable distribution of resources." End quote. A UBI is an important step on the path to creating greater equality, empowering people with enough basic income to meet their needs and giving them the dignity to make decisions in their own interest and not what is paternalistically demanded of them. If those with good incomes are free to choose how to spend their money, then why should those on low incomes not be afforded the same privilege? By detaching welfare from conditionality, a UBI brings social justice to social norms surrounding low income and those worst off in society. That sums up what a UBI is and some of the key social justice reasons why it should be universal, basic, and a form of unconditional income. But there are other reasons why it is becoming an increasingly important social imperative. One you may have heard is the threat of technology and automation replacing jobs and leaving people out of work. There's certainly merit in this argument. The interim findings of a working study of the US labour market, just released this month by the US Bureau of Economic Research, found that wage declines of 50 to 70% have occurred in sectors where automation has replaced up to 70% of jobs. It's no surprise that production and fulfillment-based industries have been revolutionised by technology. However, should we be concerned that all of our jobs will soon be replaced by machines? I don't think so, but we do need to consider the impact of technology that adapts and evolves much faster than we do. For every job that becomes obsolete due to automation, another role is created. From packing boxes, the job now becomes monitoring the robot that packs the boxes, or writing the software that tells the robot how to pack the boxes, or designing or building the robot, or installing it or maintaining it. If anything, technology is making obsolete the least desirable jobs. However, it's a question of timing. A robot can replace your job tomorrow, but a box packer cannot become a software programmer the day after. Changing the labour character of skills and industries is not an overnight process. It's generational. We may be able to learn new skills, but the more complex and niche those skills are, the more difficult they are to learn during the middle of your career. A UBI is part of the equation by acknowledging the reality that the job landscape is changing due to the so-called fourth industrial revolution. It relieves pressure on individuals to have to work. It relieves the burden on the welfare system to have to facilitate a basic income for people in many and varied circumstances, and it enables people to retrain so they can change jobs and rejoin the workforce. It changes the situation from one of desperation to one of managed progress. Let's be clear about something. As I see it, UBI is not about paying people to be idle while the robots do all of the work. To believe this is to fundamentally misunderstand what it is to be human. There are always exceptions, but we should not characterize all people according to a minority. The overwhelming majority of people want to work and do work. Work is important to us because we need a purpose, a reason to get up in the morning. Even the most mundane of jobs has psychological benefits by giving us a purpose, allowing us to fit in with similarly aligned individuals, and to exist within a social group. We need a purpose and we want to belong. I've discussed these concepts extensively throughout the podcast. One theory which describes this property of humans is self-determination theory, proposed by Desi and Ryan in the late 90s. To be psychologically healthy, we need to feel like we are masters of our destiny, that we have a sense of autonomy and identity that we associate with where we fit into our society. There are pros and cons to this. Associating identity too closely with one aspect of our lives at the expense of balance is not a good thing. But we like to work because it fulfills our need to determine our own path through life. However, our choices are often limited because we are constrained in the work we do due to financial limitations, a lack of opportunity, or just plain bad luck. A UBI relieves some of this pressure and reinforces our individual autonomy. It gives us greater freedom to choose how we work. It doesn't stop us from wanting to work altogether. Indeed, as it is a basic income, it cannot replace work. We need more than it can ever provide. However, as we have seen, it gives us greater freedom to work in areas that we may not otherwise be able to had we been trapped because of the income we need from our primary position. For instance, you may work in a position that pays a good wage but is not very fulfilling. I don't know, say you're a sales rep, but you'd really rather be on the tools building the machines that you sell. You have to spend a lot of nights away from home and meet sales targets and you're just fed up with it. But if you quit to become a mechanic, then you'd have to take a pay cut, and you have bills to pay and mouths to feed. How would you explain to your spouse that everyone will have to make sacrifices because you want to do something else? It makes the choice a selfish one, and for most of us, we'll never make that choice. A UBI bridges that gap by offsetting the lost income, allowing you to be more fulfilled. It can even encourage the U-turn that I spoke about with Bruce Grierson a couple of months ago. It's impossible to quantify what a society would look like where people have greater freedom to do what they want without money being their primary concern. But I can say with some confidence that I think it would make people happier, and happier people are healthier and kinder. Imagine the flow-on effects of a society of more content people who feel less like they are stuck on a treadmill. Which brings me to my next point. Health. Income is a significant social determinant of health. Social determinants are things which impact our well-being. Income insecurity, food insecurity, stress, precarity, all of these things lead to us feeling worse. The association between mental and physical health is well established. People who live their lives under stress have higher incidences of high blood pressure, strokes, and other cardiovascular events, including heart attack and death. They also have higher rates of obesity and all of the associated health problems. They suffer higher rates of mortality, depression, anxiety, and these all impact on the rate of suicide, which in New Zealand is appallingly high, especially in men and in young people. We can't say a UBI will solve this issue. It's not a silver bullet. But for the reasons I've already highlighted, it will make a difference. To not be so concerned about income, to not have to fight for welfare, to justify why you need the support week in, week out, month in, month out, this would most certainly change lives. Again, it's difficult to quantify at a conceptual level, but the reduced burden on the healthcare system would not only reduce costs, it would free up resources which are currently overtaxed. It would ease pressure on doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers. It would return to people their time wasted, sitting in waiting rooms. It would give them peace of mind and one less thing to worry about. This is one of the reasons that I said UBI is a social imperative, because it is not just about helping people that are already on welfare. It's about helping the majority of people who are in the middle class but who still struggle to make ends meet and feel trapped in their own lives due to the constraints of the economic systems which were designed to exploit us all for maximum profit. Social protection floors were implemented as a solution, but they do nothing for those people already in work that they don't enjoy or that are under stress because they feel trapped by their circumstances. UBI is a better option. Let's turn to a few examples of UBI projects from around the world to give some insight into how a UBI looks in practice and what has been learned from them. As I mentioned earlier, a national-scale UBI project has never been done, so there's always the argument to be made that small projects do not have enough predictive value. But we can still consider them on their merits and run the thought experiment. One of the more recent projects was conducted in Finland over 2 years in 2017 and 18. This is not surprising considering Scandinavia has highly progressive social policies. This project enlisted 4,000 unemployed people, split randomly into a UBI group of 2,000 people and a control group of the same number who received regular social welfare support. The UBI group was paid a basic income of €560 per month. After 2 years, the researchers evaluated the difference between the two groups across a range of metrics. There are a few key findings. The first, those in the UBI group had worked slightly more days at the end of the study than their counterparts in the control group. One of the reasons for this is that a UBI is not abated. This means as hours worked in paid employment increase, the UBI remains the same, so the earner has greater disposable income. This is in contrast to traditional welfare payments, which are abated as work hours increase. This means there's a point at which the number of hours worked means the welfare payment is entirely abated, yet this is often still quite low, making the effective tax rate on the individual close to 100%. This disincentivizes work, because if hours worked lead to less income, then it is better to stay unemployed and collect the benefit. With a UBI, work is incentivized as income increases, and you can keep the earned income in addition to the UBI. Secondly, members of the UBI group in the study reported consistently higher well-being than those on welfare. Their life satisfaction scores increased by an amount equivalent to receiving an additional €800 to €2,500 per month. In fact, the life satisfaction scores of those receiving the UBI were about the same as those in regular employment. Other measures of well-being were also much higher, that is, health, stress, depression, sadness, and loneliness. But more than this, those on the UBI reported greater confidence in their cognitive skills, subjectively assessing their ability to learn, remember, and concentrate at higher levels than those in the control group. The UBI literally made people feel better about themselves and their capabilities. Not only did the UBI increase days worked by a small margin, it increased well-being so that those people were more encouraged to seek work and to be more productive with their time. This study, therefore, fundamentally demonstrated that a UBI acts to reframe our perceptions of work and income, our place in society, and gives people the confidence to improve their lives. It's an antidote for social injustice by empowering people. The potential of it is really limitless. However, unfortunately, the trial was not seen this way, as its outcomes were primarily measured politically by the number of those on the UBI who moved into regular work. As this number was still low, critics condemned the project as a failure without recognizing the real value that the UBI offered. Confounding this was that the UBI was a substitute for welfare. Some participants were required to give up other benefits, undermining the concept of the UBI being universal and unconditional. A UBI project is currently ongoing in Spain. It came about because of COVID-19. It's the largest UBI project conducted to date by a considerable margin. It includes 850,000 low-income families from all across Spain. Individuals will receive €462 per month, while families receive up to €1,015. Many economists and social commentators are watching this project with interest. However, as with the Finnish study, we must be cautious about inferring results, as it is again limited to those most worse off in society. The UBI in Spain lacks universality, limiting its potential impacts on society as a whole and its power to improve well-being and reduce inequality. But the Spanish UBI trial demonstrates a willingness to take advantage of the opportunities presented by the pandemic to move away from traditional ideas surrounding social protection and more toward progressive policies based on good rationale and social justice. Another basic income pilot project was carried out in the Canadian province of Manitoba between 1974 and 79. It was known as Mincome, and it selected all of the residents of a small town named Dolphin to receive a basic income if they earned below the median household income for the time, which was $39,000 Canadian dollars. So it wasn't unconditional, but during the course of the project, around 2,000 people took part. A change in government led to the project being cancelled, and the collected data was hidden away for 40 years until finally it was properly analysed in 2011. The results were not surprising if you've been following the narrative so far. Guy Standing highlights some of these in his book, Basic Income, A Guide for the Open-Minded. I'll quote from that. Families receiving Mincome had fewer hospitalizations, accidents and injuries, including from domestic violence, and a lower incidence of serious mental disorders than similar non-recipient families. Youths, especially boys, were less likely to drop out of high school. Meanwhile, there was little change in hours worked by people with full-time jobs, but students and mothers with young children did reduce time in paid jobs, enabling them to spend more time on their studies or looking after their children. But there's something else. Because the Mincome payment was perceived as less stigmatizing than regular social welfare, people socialized more and enjoyed spending their time in similar ways to those with a higher socioeconomic status. This again speaks to the importance of a basic income on self-determination and that sense of autonomy and how it makes people feel. Kids stayed in school longer because they didn't have to leave early to work to support their families. They could then get a better education and be happier and more productive later on. People didn't feel like a social blight. They were equals among those earning higher incomes. By moving toward greater income equality, even if at a perceptual level, the social benefits led to a town of happier, healthier people. There really was no downside. These projects, carried out decades apart, have all had similar findings. And there have been many other UBI projects conducted around the world. You can read about these in a link in the show notes. They all come with limitations, which means that in some way they're not a true UBI, but results continually support the positive benefits that I've highlighted here. Unfortunately, the public remains to be convinced. In 2016, a referendum was held on UBI in Switzerland. The Swiss democratic system allows citizen groups to call for national referendums on specific policies if they are able to obtain over 100,000 supporting signatures. The proposal was an ingenious demonstration of democracy and how a minority group could raise awareness and open the debate surrounding UBI. However, one of its biggest flaws was that it did not indicate just how much the UBI should be. The figure of 2,500 Swiss francs per month came up and was seized upon by opponents as unaffordable. Additionally, it was argued that if Switzerland introduced a UBI, half of Europe would arrive expecting a free handout. Not surprisingly, the policy received only 23% support from the 47% of the population who turned out to vote. However, these broad stats gloss over the important details. The campaign supporters considered it a great success because it had opened the conversation and the referendum received high support in urban areas. Over two-thirds of those questioned after the referendum felt that it was just the beginning of the conversation about UBI, not the end of it. Consider also that Switzerland has one of the highest standards of living in the world, with the third highest average income in the OECD. Many just do not consider UBI a social imperative because they already have a very good quality of life. While Switzerland has a long history of progressive policies, they traditionally take at least a couple of referendums before they are passed, so perhaps UBI will be better received the next time around. It's worth concluding this section by mentioning a scheme that has existed in New Zealand since 1977, which has many of the features of a UBI. It's the New Zealand Superannuation Scheme. To qualify for it, you just need to reach the age of 65, so it's conditional upon age, but other than that, recipients receive a basic income paid fortnightly directly to their bank account. The amount paid varies depending on living circumstances, that is, whether you're married or living alone. Clearly, there are limitations to what can be inferred from the New Zealand superannuation scheme as it would apply to the wider population, particularly as pertains to work. The idea behind the NZS is that people reach the age of 65 and retire, so it's a way of ensuring that people have a basic income to survive on after a lifetime of work and paying taxes. However, many people do not hit 65 and retire, even though they may be financially secure without the NZS, or the NZS is sufficient to meet their needs. They continue working for a few more years. In 2019, over 170,000 people over 65 remained in the New Zealand workforce, so even people who have reached the end of their working lives and are paid not to work still work. The cohort of over 65s in New Zealand enjoys the highest standards of living of any demographic in New Zealand and also has the lowest rate of poverty anywhere in the OECD. This provides an interesting glimpse into what society with the UBI could look like. The elephant in the room is, how do we pay for this? If UBI is so good, then how are we going to afford it? And it may sound like a cop-out not to address this here, but my intention has primarily been to demonstrate the social justice benefits of a UBI, and as you know, this has taken quite a lot of time. Suffice to say, there are a variety of realistic and feasible proposals for funding a UBI. One that I particularly like has been written about for over three decades by the New Zealand economist Keith Rankin. I had an extensive email dialogue with Keith on his proposal and invited him a couple of times to join me on the podcast to discuss it, but unfortunately, I've not been able to convince him yet. You can find links to some of his work on UBI in the show notes if you're interested to explore this further. I really recommend it. It's very rational. The proposal is founded on many of the concepts which I introduced in the episode on redistributive social justice, particularly the idea of the wealth of the commons. Rankin describes shared national wealth as public equity derived from intellectual, sociocultural, and natural capital. Profit-making enterprises rely on the shared wealth, yet we see inequality in income throughout society, as in the example I gave of the now-defunct steel town of Middlesbrough in the UK. From this is introduced an analysis of the current tax structure in New Zealand, which is replicated around the world, and how this distorts perceptions of where we derive our income from and the role of the state with regards to tax expenditure and distribution. By restructuring the tax scheme, a UBI can be returned to income earners and substituted for benefits paid to those unemployed. The proposal is quite straightforward, so I encourage you to take a look at it for more details. In closing, there is a growing interest in a universal basic income, and many political leaders around the world are beginning to consider the merits of various proposals. A quick Google of the search term basic income came up with a long list of interesting headlines. Here's some examples. Basic income trial confirmed in Wales. Now is the time for a universal basic income. Scottish National Party blast Tories on refusal to look at universal basic income. A quick search for UBI on the popular book rating website Goodreads returned 165 results. There's also thousands of academic papers on the topic. As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, before I looked into it seriously, I thought it sounded like a nice idea, but was overly utopian and clearly unrealistic, or else we'd already be doing it. I'm pleased to say my mind has been changed. You can find a link to a paper I wrote recently on the topic in the show notes. It's a much more coherent version of this episode, which you might also find of interest. Clearly, the concept of UBI is not going away anytime soon, so it's worth educating yourself to better understand what it's all about and why is it not only a more efficient use of social welfare resources, but a moral imperative for social justice and a pathway to a more equitable society of happier, healthier people. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Here and Now podcast. You can find us on Facebook at the Here and Now podcast or Twitter at Here Now podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe to keep up to date with all of the latest episodes. And if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon or leave a review at the Apple Podcasts app. You can reach out to me via the pages or email thehereandnow@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.